Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the increasing likelihood the U.S. will be bombing Iraq soon, following a formal request from the Maliki government for airstrikes against rebels. Graham Fuller, the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA and author of Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East, joins us to discuss his article at the Huffington Post, Why America Should Let Iraq Resolve Its Own Crisis, and the need for regional powers Iran and Turkey, along with the U.S. and Russia, to weigh in to avoid a full-blown civil war as domestic pressure from America's hawks and neocons builds on Obama to intervene. Then we will speak with Eric Lecompte, the director of the Jubilee USA Network, a coalition of 75 religious, policy, labor, relief, environmental, and human rights organizations who have won more than $130 billion in debt relief for the world's poorest countries. We will discuss the recent Supreme Court ruling in favor of holdout hedge funds in a legal defeat for Argentina that the IMF is warning may have wider implications for poor nations around the world, since this ruling legitimizes the extreme behavior of these so-called vulture funds. Then finally, we'll examine the latest secret conclave of up to 300 billionaires who attended a Koch brothers-organized summit over the weekend to raise $500 million to take the Senate and another $500 million to ensure Hillary Clinton does not become president. Lauren Windsor, the executive producer of The Undercurrent on the Young Turks Network, who has an article at The Nation, exclusive behind the Koch brothers' secret billionaire summit, joins us to discuss the agenda of this secret summit that somehow she was able to infiltrate despite extreme security. And joining us now is Graham Fuller, the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief and is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including The Future of Political Islam, A World Without Islam, Three Truths and a Lie, and his latest, Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East. He also has an article at the Huffington Post, Why America Should Let Iraq Resolve Its Own Crisis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Graham Fuller.
Thank you, Ian.
And it looks as though the Obama administration is not going to take your advice and let Iraq resolve its own crises. It seems as that airstrikes are all but inevitable, with Iraq formally asking the U.S. to launch airstrikes against the rebels. Isn't this fraught with danger? Because I think this whole ISIL or ISIS idea of this lightning blitzkrieg going on in Iraq is being misreported. This is a Sunni uprising. This is not just 5,000 to 10,000 jihadis from Syria on the march towards Baghdad. Clearly involves almost the entire Sunni population of Iraq. And how can you bomb, you know, ISIS and not bomb the Sunnis?
Well, exactly. That's the problem. I do argue that I think the majority of Sunnis in the country, in fact, this would apply to much of the Muslim world, but the majority of the Sunnis in the country, I think, do not have a whole lot of truck with the kind of extremist, violent, and vicious nature of the Islamism represented by the ISIL. But, you know, at this point, they don't have a lot of confidence. They don't even feel that they're really represented by the state, and that the state is operating, you know, in a way alien to their own interests. So a lot of this is sort of support by default. And then you've got former Ba'athi elements that have always been angry about being dispossessed from power back a decade ago. So I think you're right that all kinds of unhappy Sunnis, unhappy for various reasons, and who might not necessarily agree on what the final solution of all of this should be, but are moved by the same anti-Maliki, anti-Baghdad sentiments, and that's as good as a unified movement for the time being.
But in terms of the military situation, there's some confusion over who actually has taken over the major oil refinery in Beji, northwest of Baghdad. ISIS or ISIL are saying that they have taken it over, and of course the Iraqi military spokesman is saying that they've taken it back. But also in Baiji is, of course, the main electrical generating plant for the entire country. If the rebels were able to shut that down, apparently the refinery's been shut down, but if they're able to shut down the electricity, isn't in the middle of summer, that's got to be really hard on Iraq.
Yeah, that does sound like a very distressing situation if that comes to pass. But coming back to the idea, or related to this, is what most Sunnis want, and I don't think most Sunnis are want an Islamic State of the kind that the ISIL wants. Its brutality, its violence, its intensely sectarian and vicious character. So at what point will they decide that they don't want to back this further? And most of these guys, including Al-Qaeda early on, have alienated a lot of potential supporters who are maybe, favor some degree of Islam and governance, but not the kind that these people are proposing. So the real question is, how long will the Sunni population go along for this ride? What does it take to detach large segments of that population from direct support to ISIL? Because otherwise, I just don't see ISIL as a movement, as a military strategic movement capable of taking over a country and operating the country. Destroy, yes, but build and administer, I doubt it. And this is where I think the other powers, you mean the United States or Turkey or Iran or any other numbers of countries, need to decide what it takes to break the back of support. I mean, it's almost a classic situation of uprisings and counterinsurgency globally.
Again, I'm speaking with Graham Fuller, who's a former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief and is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including The Future of Political Islam, A World Without Islam, and his latest, Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East. He also has an article at the Huffington Post, Why America Should Let Iraq Resolve Its Own Crisis. So given that Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps and the Quds Force apparently are in protecting Kabul, there's still a potential, I believe, that the ISIL insurgents might, they apparently have said they want to blow up some of these shrines in Samarra, which of course was the trigger that set off the original sectarian civil war back in the mid-2000s. So what's your sense then of how this could get further out of control, as opposed to what you were just suggesting, and that is some of the powers in the neighborhood, along with the United States and Russia, should be weighing in?
Well, I think the seizure and destruction of shrines in Samarra and elsewhere would be, yes, absolutely disastrous. And, of course, that's the very reason why ISIL would like to do it. But I think there are probably elements, even within the kind of jihadi forces, who do not totally favor such an action, which would be a real tipping point for their own future. Furthermore, there are probably a lot of Sunnis who are angry about the loss of power, angry about the anti-Sunni discrimination of this Maliki government, but who really don't want to get into the game of blowing up each other's holy shrines. I think they would see this as verging on madness. So yes, it could happen. It has happened elsewhere, and in Bamiyan and Afghanistan. But I think the general tenor of support, even by those hostile to Maliki, is not there. The other element I think is important to deal with and think about are the those who do not support the government of Maliki and his policies over the past many years. A key figure in this area is Muqtada al-Sadr, who was one on the U.S. top of the U.S. hit list for a very long time, as an anti-American Shiite activist. He comes from one of the most important families in Iraq. His father and grandfather have been grand Ayatollahs, and they are very much pan-Iraqi nationalists in that sense. So this whole sectarian thing, as if this was some eternal struggle, is just not the case. You had Iraq has been represented by a very definitely has shown pan-Arab or pan-Iraqi instincts, and Muqtada al-Sadr is one of them who shares those views and would like to work with the Sunnis for an Iraqi state that strengthens them, strengthens Islam, whether it's Sunni or Shia, it is Islam. I think he is one of the voices and forces that commands a lot of authority. Also, Ayatollah Sistani, who is probably the most revered Shiite leader, definite moderate. When it comes to protecting Shiite lives and shrines, you better believe that he believes that being at the barricades. But short of that, he does not see this as a war to the death with Sunnis at all and wants to build a strong Iraq. So it's not like this is a clear, Sunni versus Shiite division here. You've got divisions among Sunnis and among Shiites. And I think there's some room there to work to try to tamp down and weaken, if not end, the actions of these jihadis.
But given these powerful religious figures and with their strong family histories and their Iraqi nationalism, why is it then that this Dawa head, Maliki, has been able to accrue so much power and be so detrimental to the very notion that you just suggested, which is of a unity government?
Well, Iraq has unfortunately been a tough state to rule, and its tradition has been that of strong men in leadership roles. And Maliki has been gravitating in that direction more and more. I would have to say, in fairness to at least partial defense of Maliki, is that he perceives that there are forces in the Arab world and even inside Iraq who view Shiite power as illegitimate and something that needs to be reversed. And, of course, Saudi Arabia is at the very top of that list. They haven't even sent an ambassador to Baghdad and view this as some sort of an abomination that Shia should be running the country. So I think he and all kinds of other leaders within the Iraqi government, Shiite leaders, are absolutely determined that they are not going to have this prize that came to them through democratic process. They are the majority, after all, that they are not going to have this prize taken away from them by the Saudis or Sunni jihadis or anybody else, and they're playing a very tough game. But sadly, Maliki has gone beyond that. In acting even pretty strongly against even opposition among Shiite, other Shiite groups. And he wants to hold on to power. It's not the first time we see this in history.
And there doesn't appear to be anything on the Sunni side that mirrors what you described in terms of Muqtada al-Sadr and the Ayatollah Sistani.
Well, there is, I think, in some way. Everybody is, mentions the Muslim Brotherhood as if this was some fearsome organization, but it, I think, in the range of general range of Islamic or Islamist thinking within the region, it's somewhat moderate. And furthermore, the Muslim Brotherhood has never had this huge anti-Shiite drive behind it. It's indeed, nor has Iran. Iran has always felt that it could deal with the Muslim Brotherhood. It has. It dealt with Hamas as the revolutionary Palestinian liberation organization in Palestine, Muslim Brotherhood organization. It's talked about for years in terms of Iran's revolution has meaning not just for Shiites alone at all, but for Islam as a whole and even for the oppressed of the world, is the way they started talking about this. So I don't think Iran either wants to have Iraq turn into some Shiite rump state, or that they are a dagger drawn with the Sunnis. It's the Sunnis who are pressing this argument. So, for example, the Muslim Brotherhood in Iraq, it's probably much weakened now, and its leader was charged with murder. This was at a time during the Civil War when all kinds of people were killing people on other sides, and who knows what this leader may have ordered or not ordered under what circumstances. But anyway, that they have never been strongly anti-Shiite, but the leader has taken refuge in Turkey. And that's one of the reasons why Maliki has been angry at Turkey, because he feels that Turkey has been harboring some of his enemies. Well, the Muslim Brotherhood also is a Sunni organization that I think does not want to see such sectarian struggle in the country. It's a bigger vision of Islam. Iran's is as well. So I think there are elements to work with, but when blood is being shed and we see these horrendous images on television, it's pretty hard to find moderates.
And in terms of the U.S. being asked formally by Iraq to launch airstrikes against rebels, assuming that goes ahead, President Obama's meeting with key senators on Wednesday, but it seems that he's sort of being buffaloed into this. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, I do very much, Ian. I mean, I think Obama understands that having just gotten out of Iraq, that the last thing in the world he wants to do is get back into some slippery slope of going back in, and that this will then commit the U.S. irrevocably towards the Shiite side of the struggle, which will hugely increase opposition against the United States in Iraq and even outside. But my sense is that so much of this is driven domestically in the United States that, you know, we see these images on television. We've been down this road many, many times, but and neocons and ultra-conservatives and hawks all saying, for God's sake, where is our leadership? What are we doing? Why aren't we taking sides in this? Why aren't we making our presence felt, our force put to use? And I think he's probably dragging his feet and trying to do the bare minimum, but feels he's got to do something just to show that he's done something.
But again, as we pointed out earlier, how do your bombs distinguish between Sunnis who you might need to work with later to build in Iraq and these crazy ISIL people who...
Well, I don't think the technology is there yet.
So that's the problem. Now, just in the last couple of minutes there, Graham Fuller, the one sort of bright spot in this otherwise bleak picture is, of course, the Kurdish North, and they've managed, apparently, the two kind of... Talibani and Barzani clans have managed to get together. They seem to be an island of stability, but there are also forces pushing them, are there not?
Well, yes. We had neglected to mention the Kurds when I was talking about other forces that might be able to play some role in this. The Kurds obviously are in some sense beneficiary of internal struggles in Iraq, because it simply enables them to strengthen their own internal autonomy, which has been growing and growing and growing as it works towards de facto independence almost. But the Kurds do not really benefit from such ugliness and conflict and war around them, and they can get drawn in and their interests suffer. And furthermore, the Kurds have worked with Maliki. The president of Iraq is a Kurd, a distinguished Kurd. So they have good channels with the government, with Maliki, and Kurds are Shiite or Sunni, but I think they're less involved in this kind of sectarian struggle than others. I would be surprised if that broke down along strongly sectarian lines. So yeah, the Kurds could be a very positive force in this, and furthermore, in close contact with Turkey. So there's room there, and indeed the president of Iraq, as I mentioned, who is a Kurd, Talabani, has very good ties with Iran. He spent years in Iran. So I think the wherewithal is there for some kind of people to get together and do this that doesn't necessarily involve bombs, whether they're smart Shiite Sunni bombs or not. You're right, bombs are going to be escalating the conflict.
Well, just in the last few seconds then, is there any evidence, Graham Fuller, that the U.S., the Russians, the Iranians, the Kurds, and the Turks are talking, or any combination of them are talking to try and resolve this situation?
Ian, I don't know that. If I hope it's going on. It's vitally important that this be going on. And the State Department and CIA would not be doing their jobs if they weren't out there talking and seeking some kind of common ground somewhere to do it. But as I say, in the middle of brutal killing, it's very hard to get people to calm down enough to talk about these things. But the wherewithal is there. And I think it's a terrible mistake for Westerners to just assume that, oh, well, what do you expect? Sunnis always kill Shiites and vice versa. That's just not the way most of history has worked. It's not the way human character works, that they want to be in eternal conflict with their neighbors. So it may get a little uglier before there's any improvement. And indeed, the rising ugliness may just push the various players to realize that they've got something has got to be done. But I don't see this as the beginning of an apocalyptic ending of the state. And I just hope that all these alternative forces can somehow manage to do something before it's gets even worse.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Graham Fuller.
Thank you, Ian. My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Graham Fuller, who's a former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief and is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including The Future of Political Islam, A World Without Islam, Three Truths and a Lie, and his latest book, Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East. He also has an article at the Huffington Post, Why America Should Let Iraq Resolve Its Own Crisis. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into a Supreme Court ruling in favor of so-called vulture funds.
The peddlers and the meddlers, they buy and they sell. They destroyed your city, they'll destroy you as well. The lecherous and treacherous, a hair meant for leather. Each of them bigger than all men put together. Sluggers and muggers, wearing fancy gold.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Eric Lecompte, who is the director of the Jubilee USA Network, a coalition of 75 religious, policy, labor, relief, environmental, and human rights organizations advocating for solutions to the international debt crisis. Jubilee USA Network has won critical global financial reforms and more than $130 billion in debt relief from the world's poorest countries so the money could be reinvested in social infrastructure. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eric Lecompte.
Thanks, Ian.
And the Supreme Court recently ruled in favor of bondholders and hedge funds demanding that Argentina pay them back $1.3 billion. And this, of course, has already run up Argentina's – made it more expensive for Argentina to borrow money. And, of course, Argentina is recovering from collapse of its economy back in 2001. What's your sense then of let's just go to the Supreme Court ruling itself. What do you understand was in the minds of the Supreme Court justices in ruling in favor of these predatory debt collectors who are often referred to as vulture funds?
Well, it's hard to say. No one's able to get into the mind of the justices, and unfortunately, none of us have a crystal ball. But it's clear that the decision that was made by the Supreme Court justices not to hear an appeal from Argentina when the predatory hedge funds had won the lower courts, essentially, the Supreme Court justices made a decision that has negative consequences for the world's poorest people, the poorest economies in the world, but also international debt restructuring, and even a decision that has negative consequences for big business and legitimate Wall Street investors. So the decision that was made is one that has adverse consequences even on the operation of the international financial system.
But these so-called vulture funds, they're holding out for 100% of the value, but they bought this debt for pennies on the dollar. So the Supreme Court, is in effect, has allowed them to reap these extraordinary profits. And doesn't this ruling by the Supreme Court legitimize the extreme behavior of these vulture funds across the globe?
It very much does. And, we ask, why is the Supreme Court deciding on a case between Argentina and a group of hedge funds and holdout creditors? What we have to understand is that much of the world of sovereign debt is negotiated in the state of New York. Contracts are signed by debt and on bonds between countries and firms and investors in New York, and so it's governed under New York state law. And essentially, we've had this case in the U.S. courts since Argentina defaulted in 2001, and the country went through a financial disaster. At that time, a small group of predatory hedge funds came in and bought up the debt, as you're saying, for pennies on the dollar, and then using the fact that the contract was signed in New York, they've been suing in full since then. And since then, more than 92% of all of those who had debt with Argentina restructured, except for this group of holdout creditors that have been led by these vulture funds.
But the people who settled represent 92% of the creditors on the defaulted debt, and they agreed back in 2005 to write off two-thirds of the pre-crisis value. So it's only the 8% of these hedge funds, the vulture funds, that held out against this restructuring, and they've just been handed a victory by the Supreme Court. So the Supreme Court's ruling in favor of the 8% minority.
That's right, which is, again, I think there is a consensus among conservatives and progressives that this is a court, a Supreme Court, that in general is very much pro-business and pro-Wall Street. But that's also part of the surprise in the decision that the reality that both business interests as well as, the majority of investors on Wall Street are also negatively affected by the Supreme Court deciding not to hear this decision. This particular case, aside from, having significant financial impacts for investors and even how the state of New York is used as a jurisdiction anymore for, signing contracts, we have to understand that this also deals fundamentally with how the financial system operates. As difficult as it is for Argentina, the Supreme Court has now set a precedent in case law that essentially is equipping these predatory hedge funds with a new powerful ruling that will automatically force poor countries like the Ivory Coast and Zambia into submission. So part of the power of this particular ruling and what's happened in the court is not whether or not Argentina pays at the end of the day. It seems Argentina will find a way to avoid paying the predatory hedge funds, but it's how this ruling will be used to force the poorest economies in the world into submission from these predatory funds.
And again, I'm speaking with Eric Lecomte, who's the director of the Jubilee USA Network, a coalition of 75 religious, policy, labor, relief, environmental, and human rights organizations advocating for solutions to the international debt crisis. Jubilee USA Network has won critical global financial reforms and more than $130 billion in debt relief for the world's poorest countries so the money could be reinvested in social infrastructure. Well, to your point that you just made then, Eric, the International Monetary Fund has warned that Argentina's defeat by the Supreme Court in its fight against these hedge fund vulture capitalists will have wider implications. So just walk us through what you think is likely to happen to these other countries like Ivory Coast and Zambia.
Well, you know, what's amazing about this case is that this is a unique global consensus, you know, that's against this predatory behavior. We have to understand, you know, the world's poorest countries of the world are against this behavior, as well as the world's wealthiest countries, because this behavior is so extreme. In fact, you know, the ruling by the Supreme Court will even undermine what's been 15 years of bipartisan policy between Republicans and Democrats to win $130 billion in debt relief. These predatory hedge funds, part of how they operate is by targeting a country or suing when a country has assets. And so often those assets come from debt relief that the International Monetary Fund that you've mentioned or the Paris Club have, you know, essentially been able to send to a country. And then those assets, like in the famous case of Zambia from just a few years ago, when one vulture fund essentially took the money that was supposed to be used to build schools in Zambia that had come in for debt relief. So there's a global consensus, you know, among the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the U.S. government, and legitimate investors that this behavior is so extreme, we need to find ways to outlaw it. So the International Monetary Fund has really looked at the Argentina case very seriously in the last 3 years. And in particular, during the course of the last G20 meetings, again, because this behavior is just so extreme, the G20 encouraged the IMF to look at how do we resolve the issues that create this kind of behavior? How do we stop it? So this past Friday, when the International Monetary Fund met, the executive directors of all the countries met, they looked at solutions on this. And one of the specific things that they've been reviewing is this idea of collective action clauses in debt contracts. So when countries sign a contract, there's a collective action clause that would protect both the country and the investor from these predatory hedge funds and predatory investors. So that's one solution that, you know, is being utilized around the world and now is being promoted. But it's helpful in the sense that it's a step in the right direction in preventing some future behavior. But unfortunately, the consequences, you know, are right now. And some of the consequences, the IMF and the World Bank, the U.S. government, and that we've specifically articulated at Jubilee USA is that, you know, this could make it difficult for any country, let alone a very poor country, to restructure their debts, you know, trapping a country in poverty. It could make it very difficult for investors to want to be able to work for a solution with a country that's in the best interest of all involved. It'll make it very difficult for poor countries to get access to credit and capital. So there are many consequences, and it even affects us as U.S. taxpayers, because the money that essentially has now been legitimized for these vulture funds to collect is money that comes from U.S. aid often or from debt relief, which is funded by our tax dollars, and these very vulture funds are going to be collecting our tax money now that this is a more considered to be profitable and legitimate.
Well, I recall recently, Eric Lecomte, that one of these vulture funds was able to seize a Argentine tall ship, a training ship, a big sailing ship. I think it was somewhere in Africa. Is that predatory vulture capitalist fellow called Singer? Is he involved in this?
Yes. So he's one of the principal actors in this particular case, and he is someone that essentially right now is the founder of NML Capital and a lot of this global behavior. So his hedge firm, his hedge fund rather, NML Capital, has been the leader in this particular case in Argentina, and they had seized an Argentine vessel last year in Ghana, but the Supreme Court of Ghana ordered that the vessel be released and that the hedge funds have no claim. The reality of it is right now the United Nations calls the state of New York the preferred jurisdiction for predatory hedge funds, that this is the preferred jurisdiction to house this behavior, because the other financial jurisdictions and centers of the world where these contracts are signed, the behavior is not tolerated or courts consistently rule against these extreme actors. So in London and Paris and Frankfurt, you know, there isn't a taste for this kind of behavior. So at this point, you know, it's operating out of the United States and using U.S. courts, New York courts, in order to do their dirty work.
And the highest court in the land has just legitimized these vulture funds.
That's right. And so, you know, what the International Monetary Fund is doing is important. It's a step in the right direction. And we have to understand that there are various processes that are happening at the United Nations that we're a part of as UN expert groups that are working to essentially prevent this behavior from ever happening by implementing an international bankruptcy process. There's also moves that, you know, we're working with members of Congress as well as folks in the New York State Assembly in order to find ways to challenge this behavior and outlaw it. So, well, you know, in no way is the fight over, but, you know, certainly today, you know, the victory has gone to these predatory hedge funds.
Well, Eric Lecompa, thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks, Ian. Be well.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Eric Lecompa, who is the director of the Jubilee USA Network, a coalition of 75 religious, policy, labor, relief, environmental, and human rights organizations advocating for solutions to the international debt crisis. Jubilee USA Network has won critical global financial reforms and more than $130 billion in debt relief for the world's poorest countries so the money could be reinvested in social infrastructure. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking with Lauren Windsor, who infiltrated the secret Koch Brothers Billionaire Summit. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Lauren Windsor, the executive producer of The Undercurrent, a grassroots political news program on the Young Turks Network. She's also the creative director of American Family Voices, a progressive nonprofit focusing on banking and campaign finance reform. And she blogs under the name Lady Libertine. And she has an article at The Nation, exclusive behind the Koch Brothers Secret Billionaire Summit. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lauren Windsor.
Thanks, Ian.
And in your article, according to one source at this gathering that took place at Dana Point in California at the St. Regis Monarch Bay Resort over the weekend, that these billionaires gathering under the auspices of the Koch brothers, apparently there are 300 individuals worth at least $1 billion each. They're trying to raise $500 million to take control of the Senate and another $500 million to make sure Hillary Clinton never becomes president. This has to be one of the biggest conclaves of billionaires on the planet.
Certainly. The numbers were quite shocking when I heard them, but the source seems to be well-placed from all that I gathered.
But the range of billionaires, I mean, first of all, let's go through some of the political representatives there. Tom Cotton, Republican of Arizona, Cory Gardner, Jim Jordan of Ohio, Senators Mitch McConnell and Marco Rubio, they were all in attendance. But what I found extraordinary was that Michael Lomax, the president of the United Negro College Fund, was also there, and it surprises me. I mean, I know the Koch brothers liked to be philanthropists and give money to worthy causes, but their policies and the money they've spent on voter suppression hardly helps the African-American community.
Yes, that was shocking to me as well. But you know, as you all know, the $25 million donation that the Kochs made to the United Negro College Fund has drawn a storm of criticism for Michael Lomax. So when I saw his name on the agenda, I was curious, definitely about what more might be required of him, given that this is a pretty big commitment to be sitting in on political strategy sessions for the Koch brothers. The title of the panel that he participated on was Part One, Drive the National Conversation, which was a segment of a larger afternoon session called The Foundation for Progress.
And the overall theme of this conference, which I take it is fairly secret, right? There was no announcements. There was a lot of security. Well, why don't you describe the scene, since you somehow or other managed to get on the inside and get this information and get this documentation that's available in your article, exclusive article that you have at The Nation?
Well, anyone that's familiar with Orange County, Laguna Beach, Dana Point, you can't imagine, you know, a better geographical setting. You know, I described it as idyllic in the piece. The St. Regis is a luxury hotel, so, you know, they have the golf course, the Monarch Bay golf course. You know, the accommodations range to actually, like, unlisted amounts, like a base price of, like, $495 to, you know, unlimited. For the presidential suites, according to a source, the conference was offered the presidential suites at $2,000 a night. According to the source, the conference overall cost to Freedom Partners was estimated at $870,000. But that doesn't include the actual cost of the room, because the cost of the rooms is the responsibility of the attendees.
Well, since a lot of them are billionaires, I'm imagine it's not a big imposition on them, right?
Certainly not. I mean, obviously it's pocket change to them, but when you're talking about spending nearly $1 million just to lock down a hotel for a weekend, you know, obviously security is a priority for you. Not only did they have a lot of security from the hotel, but they had their own security team. Every entry point to the hotel had security officers. Going into the hotel, guests were greeted at the gate with security officers, but then also employees of Freedom Partners or Koch Industries. It wasn't clear as to their official employer, but they were, you know, conference staff with iPads that, you know, for checking in each of the guests. And then once those guests arrived at the front door, they were greeted by another group of security and staff employees.
Now, the conference of the secret mega donors was called American Courage, Our Commitment to a Free Society. Well, it seems our society may be free, but it's also for sale, is it not?
Yes. That freedom comes at a pretty steep price, I think. And I guess we have to start to think about freedom in terms of whose freedom. Is it the freedom of the American public at large, or is it the freedom of billionaires to, you know, blatantly pursue safeguarding their own financial interests?
So was that the reason for the secrecy then, that so many of these billionaires have publicly traded companies, that they don't want the publicity, that they are so partisan and so interested in protecting their prerogatives?
Well, according to, I guess, Freedom Partners in the past and in other articles, there has been a huge backlash against Coke Industries itself, death threats, alleged death threats, you know, lots of negative publicity around the Koch brothers themselves. And participants within the summit, you know, would prefer not to receive that same negative publicity. I would draw a comparison to the American Legislative Exchange Council, you know, where after Stand Your Ground and ALEC became much more visible to the public, its corporate membership was threatened with boycotts, and you saw a mass exodus of many of the member corporations from ALEC.
So in this case where you've got people from the big pharma, the heads of the big pharmaceutical company Allergan and others who were there, what is the...
I don't know specifically if the head of Allergan, or the founder, I should say, Gavin Herbert, was there at the conference. According to the agenda and other documents, according to the source documents, there was a special top donor dinner given at La Casa Pacifica, which is owned by Mr. Herbert, the founder of Allergan, which was the former home of President Nixon that came to be known as the Western White House during his presidency.
So, but these panels that they had seemed to be, I mean, for example, they have panels on how to attack climate change and the science of climate change, but they didn't have any scientists, right? These are, so the focus seems to be on how to best frame your political message rather than...
Well, they were messaging operatives. So we don't have any scientists involved, but have messaging operatives involved. And the title, I mean, look at the messaging in the name of the panel itself. The name of the panel is Energy, you know, Changing the Narrative. So presumably, given the way they talk about this, they don't say climate change. They say energy independence. So, of course, like, doesn't energy independence sound great? Doesn't everyone want to, you know, not depend on foreign oil to get our energy? Yeah, I think most people would agree with that. However, we can be energy independent without relying on fossil fuels. So, you know, the framework there is really telling as to their point of view.
Well, for example, just to give you a sense of the attitudes of these plutocrats in terms of these panels that they have, one is called Employee Outreach, Engaging Your Workforce in the Cause of Freedom. In other words, forcing them to buy into your political agenda. Another one is Texas, Sustaining a Culture of Freedom in the Lone Star State, and Well-Being, What It Is and Why It's Important. And then the one that I find extraordinary is The Emigrant Experience. Now, what were they talking about on that panel?
Well, that actually, the Immigrant Experience Dinner was an internal title that was on a different document that unfortunately we couldn't make public. So, you know, internally they're calling it the Immigrant Experience Dinner, and then, you know, presumably within the draft agenda it just says dinner remarks by Marco Rubio.
Oh, so, I see. So the only immigrant experience probably in that room, apart from Marco Rubio, are the people serving the food, right, and the drinks.
Maybe so.
Right. So the idea that you can have 300 billionaires, and that seems an extraordinary figure. I don't know how many. According to Forbes magazine, there are 492 billionaires in the United States. So it looks like the Koch brothers have cornered the market on billionaires.
If that number is to be believed, yes. I mean, it's shocking that you would have, you know, more than 60% of the nation's billionaires all in attendance for this one summit.
And on the other side, in terms of, particularly in terms of trying to propagate the science of global warming and fight against the global warming denial, which is hugely funded by the Kochs, is, of course, the California billionaire Tom Steyer. So it doesn't seem like it's a particularly level playing field here in terms of right-wing plutocrats as opposed to left-wing plutocrats.
Yes, and people that try to draw that comparison between Steyer and the Kochs, I mean, it's a total false equivalence. You know, Steyer doesn't have, you know, a huge conglomerate, you know, the second largest private company, their financial interests at heart. I don't think that there's a clearer example of the problem with money in politics than the Koch brothers. When you look at their financial interests and the amount of money they pump into our political process, and then the outcomes in their favor for deregulating, you know, carbon regulations to any number of the issues that they work on, fighting Obamacare, and their beliefs go back like several decades. You know, they've been quite clear. You know, they've founded the libertarian movement. So,
well,
to me, it's just
so
the clearest cut example of the problem of money in politics.
Well, if indeed the purpose of this secret meeting in down in Orange County over the weekend at Dana Point at this luxury resort, this St. Regis Monarch Bay Resort, if the purpose, as stated, was to raise $500 million to take the Senate in the 2014 midterms and another $500 million to make sure Hillary Clinton is never president, even if there weren't 300 billionaires, maybe, say, let's say, we're only 150, that's still pocket change for them, isn't it? I mean, there's not...
Right. I mean, even if you take half the number of billionaires, and we should be clear, too, that this individual said worth at least $1 billion each. So presumably there would be many billionaires, you know, with multiple billions of dollars. So we're not talking about, you know, if you took half the number, that 150 billionaires were there, that's not $150 billion. It's potentially, you know, many multiples of that.
So, Lauren Windsor, the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Human Rights Subcommittee of the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee are meeting on Wednesday to consider a vote on Senate Resolution Number 19, a constitutional amendment proposed by U.S. Senator Tom Udall that aims to overturn Citizens United and other U.S. Supreme Court decisions relating to campaign finance. So, was there any discussion of this? I mean, do they see both Senator Udall's and also the majority leader, Senator Reid's efforts to overturn Citizens United as any kind of threat? Was there any discussions on that?
I don't know the contents of his particular speech, but Senator McConnell addressed both a small group and the general session in a talk called Free Speech, Defending Our First Amendment Rights. And that's according to the agenda, which can be found in the Nation article. All of the information, you know, in the agenda online. Anyway, his defense, when he sparred with Senator Reid earlier this month in a hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee, was the First Amendment argument at play for political speech, that the reason that we shouldn't regulate campaign finance further is that it would be depriving, essentially, rich people of their political speech rights. So presumably, given the title of his two talks, Free Speech Defending Our First Amendment Rights, he wasn't just talking, you know, generally about the First Amendment, but about campaign finance reform and his fight against Senator Reid in the upcoming resolution.
So this is a real problem in America, that billionaires are muzzled, that they're unable to express themselves freely.
I don't think that anyone looking at any American, if you ask them what's wrong with government today, would say that it's a dearth of money in the political process. You know, I'm pretty incredulous at the claim that billionaires are being muzzled, that McConnell and Ted Cruz and other conservatives are trying to advance.
But do these billionaires at this secret conclave, do you think they believe this stuff? I mean, what was your sense, since somehow you managed to get into this meeting, what was your sense of whether they were true believers or just cynical businessmen buying a bunch of corrupt politicians?
Well, I mean, I do believe that many of these people believe the ideology. They, you know, read Ayn Rand, you know, they worship at the altar of Milton Friedman. You know, a lot of them are entrepreneurs, and they see it as a slight. You know, why should I have to, you know, basically fork over half of my income to a government that then hands it over to the moocher class? And I say this as a reference to the Ayn Rand framework of makers and takers, where, you know, she calls anybody receiving a handout a moocher.
Even though she lived on Social Security and depended upon Medicaid towards the end of her life.
Yes, exactly. So to me, you know, I read Ayn Rand in my youth. She was one of my favorite authors at the time, but it was because I recognized her work as fiction. You know, a fictional account of, you know, an unattainable reality of, I should say, not reality, an unattainable fantasy land where people could never compromise or were able to never compromise. So when you look at her characters like Howard Rourke, when you look at John Galt, they're uncompromising on principle. And it's really illustrative of today's Republican Party. I think they all see themselves as John Galt and Howard Rourke.
Well, yeah, except they're on the payroll of the Kochs. That's the inconvenient truth, isn't it? It's one thing.
That's the cognitive dissonance at play, isn't it?
Right. Well, Lauren Windsor, I thank you very much for joining us here. And again, Lauren Windsor is the executive producer of The Undercurrent, a grassroots political news program on the Young Turks Network. She's also creative director of American Family Voices, a progressive nonprofit focusing on banking and campaign finance reform. She blogs under the name of Lady Libertine, and she has an exclusive article in The Nation, exclusive behind the Koch Brothers Secret Billionaire Summit that you were somehow able to infiltrate. So congratulations on your stealth operation.
Thanks, Ian.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graeme Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.